B. Hegel's treatment of the early Greek thinkers affords the readiest illustration of his meaning, in conceiving all philosophy under the form of opposites. The first abstraction is to him the beginning of thought. Hitherto there had only existed a tumultuous chaos of mythological fancy, but when Thales said his water a new era began to dawn upon the world. Man was seeking to grasp the universe under a single form which was at first simply a material element, the most equable and colorless, and universal which could be found. But soon the human mind became dissatisfied with the emblem, and after ringing the changes on one element after another, demanded a more abstract and perfect conception, such as one or being, which was absolutely at rest. But the positive had its negative, the conception of being involved not being, the conception of one, many, the conception of a whole, parts. Then the pendulum swung to the other side, from arrest to motion, from Xenophon's to Heraclitus. The opposition of being, and not being projected into space, became the atoms and void of Leucippus and Democritus. Until the atomists, the abstraction of the individual did not exist. In the philosophy of Anaxagoras the idea of mind, whether human or divine, was beginning to be realized. The pendulum gave another swing, from the individual to the universal, from the object to the subject. The sophist first uttered the word man is the measure of all things, which Socrates presented in a new form as the study of ethics. Once more we return from mind to the object of mind, which is knowledge, and out of knowledge the various degrees, or kinds of knowledge more or less abstract were gradually developed. The threefold division of logic, physic, and ethics, foreshadowed in Plato, was finally established by Aristotle and the Stoics. Thus, according to Hegel, in the course of about two centuries by a process of antagonism and negation the leading thoughts of philosophy were evolved. There is nothing like this progress of opposites in Plato, who in the Symposium, denies the possibility of reconciliation until the opposition has passed away. In his own words, there is an absurdity in supposing that harmony is discord, for in reality harmony consists of notes of a higher and lower pitch which disagreed once, but are now reconciled by the art of music. He does indeed describe objects of sense as regarded by us sometimes from one point of view and sometimes from another. As he says at the end of the fifth book of the Republic, there is nothing light which is not heavy, or great which is not small. And he extends this relativity to the conceptions of just and good, as well as to great and small. In like manner he acknowledges, that the same number may be more or less in relation to other numbers without any increase or diminution. But the perplexity only arises out of the confusion of the human faculties. The art of measuring shows us, what is truly great and truly small. Though the just and good in particular instances may vary, the idea of good is eternal and unchangeable. And the idea of good is the source of knowledge, and also of being, in which all the stages of sense and knowledge are gathered up and from being hypotheses become realities. Leaving the comparison with Plato we may now consider the value of this invention of Hegel. There can be no question of the importance of showing that two contraries or contradictories may in certain cases be both true. The silliness of the so-called laws of thought, all A equals A, or, in the negative form, nothing can at the same time be both A, and not A, has been well exposed by Hegel himself, who remarks that the form of the maxim is virtually self-contradictory, for a proposition implies a distinction between subject and predicate, whereas the maxim of identity, as it is called, A equals A, does not fulfill what its form requires. Nor does any mind ever think or form conceptions in accordance with this law, nor does any existence conform to it. Wisdom of this sort is well parodied in Shakespeare. Unless we are willing to admit that two contradictories may be true, many questions which lie at the threshold of mathematics and of morals will be insoluble puzzles to us. The influence of opposites is felt in practical life. The understanding sees one side of a question only, the common sense of mankind joins one of two parties in politics, in religion, in philosophy. Yet, As everybody knows, truth is not wholly the possession of either. But the characters of men are one-sided, and accept this or that aspect of the truth. The understanding is strong in a single abstract principle, and with this lever moves mankind. Few attain to a balance of principles, or recognize truly how in all human things there is a thesis and antithesis, a law of action and of reaction. In politics we require order as well as liberty, and have to consider the proportions in which under given circumstances they may be safely combined. In religion there is a tendency to lose sight of morality, to separate goodness from the love of truth, to worship God without attempting to know Him. In philosophy again there are two opposite principles, of immediate experience, and of those general or a priori truths which are supposed to transcend experience. But the common sense or common opinion of mankind is incapable of apprehending these opposite sides or views. Men are determined by their natural bent to one or other of them. They go straight on for a time in a single line, and may be many things by turns, but not at once. Hence the importance of familiarizing the mind with forms which will assist us in conceiving or expressing the complex or contrary aspects of life and nature. The danger is that they may be too much for us, and obscure our appreciation of facts. As the complexity of mechanics cannot be understood without mathematics, so neither can the many-sidedness of the mental and moral world be truly apprehended without the assistance of new forms of thought. One of these forms is the unity of opposites. Abstractions have a great power over us, but they are apt to be partial and one-sided, and only when modified by other abstractions do they make an approach to the truth. Many a man has become a fatalist, because he has fallen under the dominion of a single idea. He says to himself, for example, that he must be either free or necessary, he cannot be both. Thus in the ancient world whole schools of philosophy passed away in the vain attempt to solve the problem of the continuity or divisibility of matter. And in comparatively modern times, though in the spirit of an ancient philosopher, Bishop Berkeley, feeling a similar perplexity, is inclined to deny the truth of infinitesimals in mathematics. Many difficulties arise in practical religion from the impossibility of conceiving body and mind at once, and in adjusting their movements to one another. There is a border ground between them which seems to belong to both, and there is as much difficulty in conceiving the body without the soul as the soul without the body. To the either and or philosophy, everything is either A or not A, should at least be added the clause or neither, or both. The double form makes reflection easier, and more conformable to experience, and also more comprehensive. But in order to avoid paradox, and the danger of giving offense to the unmetaphysical part of mankind, we may speak of it as due to the imperfection of language, or the limitation of human faculties. It is nevertheless a discovery which, in Platonic language, may be termed a most gracious aid to thought. The doctrine of opposite moments of thought, or of progression by antagonism, further assists us in framing a scheme or system of the sciences. The negation of one gives birth to another of them. The double notions are the joints which hold them together. The simple is developed into the complex, the complex returns again into the simple. Beginning with the highest notion of mind or thought, we may ascend by a series of negations to the first generalizations of sense. Or again we may begin with the simplest elements of sense and proceed upwards to the highest being or thought. Metaphysic is the negation or absorption of physiology, physiology of chemistry, chemistry of mechanical philosophy. Similarly in mechanics, when we can no further go we arrive at chemistry, when chemistry becomes organic we arrive at physiology, when we pass from the outward and animal to the inward nature of man we arrive at moral and metaphysical philosophy. These sciences have each of them their own methods, and are pursued independently of one another. But to the mind of the thinker they are all one, latent in one another, developed out of one another. This method of opposites has supplied new instruments of thought for the solution of metaphysical problems, and has thrown down many of the walls within which the human mind was confined. Formerly when philosophers arrived at the infinite and absolute, They seem to be lost in a region beyond human comprehension. But Hegel has shown that the absolute and infinite are no more true than the relative and finite, and that they must alike be negatived before we arrive at a true absolute or a true infinite. The conceptions of the infinite and absolute as ordinarily understood are tiresome, because they are unmeaning, but there is no peculiar sanctity or mystery in them. We might as well make an infinitesimal series of fractions, or a perpetually recurring decimal the object of our worship. They are the widest, and also the thinnest of human ideas, or, in the language of logicians, they have the greatest extension and the least comprehension. Of all words, they may be truly said to be the most inflated with a false meaning. They have been handed down from one philosopher to another until they have acquired a religious character. They seem also to derive a sacredness from their association with the divine being. Yet they are poorest of the predicates under which we describe him, signifying no more than this, that he is not finite, that he is not relative, and tending to obscure his higher attributes of wisdom, goodness, truth. The system of Hegel frees the mind from the dominion of abstract ideas. We acknowledge his originality, and some of us delight to wander in the mazes of thought which he has opened to us. For Hegel has found admirers in England and Scotland, when his popularity in Germany has departed, and he, like the philosophers whom he criticizes, is of the past. No other thinker has ever dissected the human mind with equal patience and minuteness. He has lightened the burden of thought, because he has shown us that the chains which we wear are of our own forging. To be able to place ourselves not only above the opinions of men, but above their modes of thinking, is a great height of philosophy. This dearly obtained freedom, however, we are not disposed to part with, or to allow him to build up in a new form the beggarly elements of scholastic logic which he has thrown down. So far as they are aids to reflection and expression, forms of thought are useful, but no further. We may easily have too many of them. And when we are asked to believe the Hegelian to be the sole or universal logic, we naturally reply that there are other ways in which our ideas may be connected. The triplets of Hegel, the division into being, essence, and notion, are not the only or necessary modes in which the world of thought can be conceived. There may be an evolution by degrees as well as by opposites. The word continuity suggests the possibility of resolving all differences into differences of quantity. Again, the opposites themselves may vary from the least degree of diversity up to contradictory opposition. They are not like numbers and figures, always and everywhere of the same value. And therefore the edifice which is constructed out of them has merely an imaginary symmetry, and is really irregular, and out of proportion. The spirit of Hegelian criticism should be applied to his own system, and the terms being, not being, existence, essence, notion, and the like challenged and defined. For if Hegel introduces a great many distinctions, he obliterates a great many others by the help of the universal solvent is not, which appears to be the simplest of negations, and yet admits of several meanings. Neither are we able to follow him in the play of metaphysical fancy which conducts him from one determination of thought to another. But we begin to suspect that this vast system is not God within us, or God immanent in the world, and may be only the invention of an individual brain. The beyond is always coming back upon us, however often we expel it. We do not easily believe that we have within the compass of the mind the form of universal knowledge. We rather incline to think that the method of knowledge is inseparable from actual knowledge, and wait to see what new forms may be developed out of our increasing experience and observation of man and nature. We are conscious of a being who is without us as well as within us. Even if inclined to pantheism, we are unwilling to imagine that the meager categories of the understanding, however ingeniously arranged or displayed, are the image of God. That what all religions were seeking after from the beginning was the Hegelian philosophy which has been revealed in the latter days. The great metaphysician, like a prophet of old, was naturally inclined to believe that his own thoughts were divine realities. We may almost say that, Whatever came into his head seemed to him to be a necessary truth. He never appears to have criticized himself, or to have subjected his own ideas to the process of analysis which he applies to every other philosopher. Hegel would have insisted that his philosophy should be accepted as a whole or not at all. He would have urged that the parts derive their meaning from one another and from the whole. He thought that he had supplied an outline large enough to contain all future knowledge, and a method to which all future philosophies must conform. His metaphysical genius is especially shown in the construction of the categories, a work which was only begun by Kant, and elaborated to the utmost by himself. But is it really true that the part has no meaning when separated from the whole, or that knowledge to be knowledge at all must be universal? Do all abstractions shine only by the reflected light of other abstractions? May they not also find a nearer explanation in their relation to phenomena? If many of them are correlatives, they are not also, and the relations which subsist between them vary from a mere association up to a necessary connection. Nor is it easy to determine how far the unknown element affects the known, whether, for example, new discoveries may not one day supersede our most elementary notions about nature. To a certain extent, all our knowledge is conditional upon what may be known in future ages of the world. We must admit this hypothetical element, which we cannot get rid of by an assumption that we have already discovered the method to which all philosophy must conform. Hegel is right in preferring the concrete to the abstract, in setting actuality before possibility, in excluding from the philosopher's vocabulary the word inconceivable. But he is too well satisfied with his own system ever to consider the effect of what is unknown on the element which is known. To the Hegelian, all things are plain and clear, while he who is outside the charmed circle is in the mire of ignorance and logical impurity. He who is within is omniscient, or at least, has all the elements of knowledge under his hand. Hegelianism may be said to be a transcendental defense of the world as it is. There is no room for aspiration, and no need of any. What is actual is rational, what is rational is actual. But a good man will not readily acquiesce in this aphorism. He knows, of course, that all things proceed according to law, whether for good or evil. But when he sees the misery and ignorance of mankind, he is convinced that without any interruption of the uniformity of nature, the condition of the world may be indefinitely improved by human effort. There is also an adaptation of persons to times and countries, but this is very far from being the fulfillment of their higher natures. The man of the 17th century is unfitted for the 18th, and the man of the 18th for the 19th, and most of us would be out of place in the world of 100 years hence. But all higher minds are much more akin than they are different. Genius is of all ages, and there is perhaps more uniformity in excellence than in mediocrity. The sublimer intelligences of mankind, Plato, Dante, Sir Thomas More, meet in a higher sphere above the ordinary ways of men. They understand one another from afar, notwithstanding the interval which separates them. They are the spectators of all time, and of all existence. Their works live forever, and there is nothing to prevent the force of their individuality breaking through the uniformity which surrounds them. But such disturbers of the order of thought Hegel is reluctant to acknowledge. The doctrine of Hegel will to many seem the expression of an indolent conservatism, and will at any rate be made an excuse for it. The mind of the patriot trembles when he is told that the worst tyranny and oppression has a natural fitness. He cannot be persuaded, for example, that the conquest of Prussia by Napoleon I was either natural or necessary, or that any similar calamity befalling a nation should be a matter of indifference to the poet or philosopher. We may need such a philosophy or religion to console us under evils which are irremediable, but we see that it is fatal to the high life of man. It seems to say to us, the world is a vast system or machine which can be conceived under the forms of logic, but in which no single man can do any great good or any great harm. Even if it were 1,000 times worse than it is, it could be arranged in categories and explained by philosophers. And what more do we want? The philosophy of Hegel appeals to an historical criterion. The ideas of men have a succession in time as well as an order of thought. But the assumption that there is a correspondence between the succession of ideas in history and the natural order of philosophy is hardly true even of the beginnings of thought. And in later systems, forms of thought are too numerous and complex to admit of art racing in them a regular succession. They seem also to be in part reflections of the past, and it is difficult to separate in them what is original and what is borrowed. Doubtless they have relation to one another. The transition from Descartes to Spinoza, or from Locke to Berkeley, is not a matter of chance, but it can hardly be described as an alternation of opposites, or figured to the mind by the vibrations of a pendulum. Even in Aristotle and Plato, rightly understood, we cannot trace this law of action and reaction. They are both idealists, although to the one the idea is actual and immanent, to the other only potential and transcendent, as Hegel himself has pointed out. The true meaning of Aristotle has been disguised from us by his own appeal to fact, and the opinions of mankind in its more popular works, and by the use made of his writings in the Middle Ages. No book, except the Scriptures, has been so much read, and so little understood. The pre-Socratic philosophies are simpler, and we may observe a progress in them, but is there any regular succession? The ideas of being, change, number, seem to have sprung up contemporaneously in different parts of Greece, and we have no difficulty in constructing them out of one another. We can see that the union of being and not being gave birth to the idea of change or becoming, and that one might be another aspect of being. Again, the Eleatics may be regarded as developing in one direction into the Megarian school, in the other into the Atomists, but there is no necessary connection between them. Nor is there any indication that the deficiency which was felt in one school was supplemented or compensated by another. They were all efforts to supply the want which the Greeks began to feel at the beginning of the 6th century before Christ, the want of abstract ideas. Nor must we forget the uncertainty of chronology. If, as Aristotle says, there were Atomists before Leucippus, Eleatics before Xenophanes, and perhaps patrons of the flux before Heraclitus, Hegel's order of thought in the history of philosophy would be as much disarranged as his order of religious thought by recent discoveries in the history of religion. Hegel is fond of repeating that all philosophies still live, and that the earlier are preserved in the later. They are refuted, and they are not refuted, by those who succeed them. Once they reign supreme, now they are subordinated to a power or idea greater, or more comprehensive than their own. The thoughts of Socrates and Plato and Aristotle have certainly sunk deep into the mind of the world, and have exercised an influence which will never pass away, but can we say that they have the same meaning in modern and ancient philosophy? Some of them, as for example the words being, essence, matter, form, either have become obsolete, or are used in new senses, whereas individual, cause, motive, have acquired an exaggerated importance. Is the manner in which the logical determinations of thought, or categories as they may be termed, have been handed down to us, really different from that in which other words have come down to us? Have they not been equally subject to accident? And are they not often used by Hegel himself in senses which would have been quite unintelligible to their original inventors, as for example, when he speaks of the ground of Leibniz, everything has a sufficient ground, as identical with his own doctrine of the notion, or the being, and not being of Heraclitus as the same with his own becoming.